Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today I have Pete Brown, former colleague, former boss, current friend. How's that for presumption? Windows platform evangelist, blinky light guy, XAML expert. Pete, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I am extremely good, extremely well, and very, very happy to have you here. It's been a little while since we've talked, especially on the podcast.
I know. It has. Too long, I think.
And in that time, you have become a platform evangelist for Microsoft. So you're ensconced in DPE.
Oh, I am now. Yep, in corporate DPE. So it's kind of the same thing we used to do, when you were working on the team, except now those are all the things that I'm supposed to be doing.
Right.
So as before, it was all like, shh, don't tell anybody, but we're going to try and like write all these blog posts about this stuff. And now it's, you know, that's what I'm supposed to be doing. So it's pretty
And you good. Have budget, which is unheard of.
Yeah, it absolutely amazing. So when somebody tells me, you know, don't worry about the cost for this thing, just get it done, it stops me in my tracks because I'm just not sure how to proceed at that point because I'm not used to that. It's it's absolutely crazy.
I love it. I'm totally envious. And you are the gadget guy, which is on your signature. It's got a little microchip flashing.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I still do lots of things with gadgets and stuff. I haven't written as much about it lately just because I've been swamped with a lot of Windows 8 work. Imagine that. I've been busy with my job and not like lots of other things to fill the gaps there. But I do a lot with, you know, Netuino and Gadgeteer, which lets you do, C# and .NET on tiny devices. And I've also gotten into more recently more kind of hardcore C programming on ARM microcontrollers. Wow. So it's crazy stuff. It's, you know, you're always looking for that thing that brings you back to those early days of programming, you know, where it sort of feels like the Wild West and you're kind of right on the metal. And if you do the wrong thing, you can completely brick whatever it is you're working on.
So what's next, assembly or machine code?
Yes, I'm going to stay away from assembly for the moment. It's not that it's impossible, because it certainly isn't, but it's just it's the too many rows and columns that are even. It just it hurts my eyes to look at it.
Does Microsoft still have an assembly compiler?
I think you can do inline assembly in C++, if I remember correctly. Actually, I know you can, because the game developers will do that sometimes, even in Windows. So
ouch. That's painful. So tell me what you're doing for Windows. What's your primary area right now focus? That put that together into an English sentence, will you?
There is a sentence in there somewhere. So I focus on a couple of different things, right? So you may have noticed, just nod and say, yes, Pete, I read your blog every day.
Every day.
You may have noticed that I've been writing a bit more lately on things like traits of quality apps for Windows. So, and by quality, I mean, you know, good apps as opposed to, you know, just sort of writing junk and stuff. So I've spent a fair bit of time focusing on quality apps. And then within that, I tend to focus on XAML and C# just because that's where my experience is. And I happen to enjoy programming in those. Plus a little bit in C++ in Windows. I've been dabbling a bit there, and I'm getting schooled a lot by people in the community who've been helping me relearn C++ after all these years. But I've gotten into that a bit because I love synthesizers and I love music apps. And really, those are best done in C++. And I've just wanted to get a better understanding of how to make really cool apps that do that.
Now, before we miss the opportunity, your blog is 10, that's 10, rem.net.
Why, yes, it is. And for folks who might wonder why I have such a crazy name, one, it's a 5-letter domain name, which is almost impossible to get. But it's also, the first line of every Commodore 64 program that you ever wrote back in the day, you know, sixth grade, fifth grade, seventh grade, whatever.
High school, always, college, but okay, I'm a lot older.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just deliberately trying to make you feel old there.
Thank you.
But it's always, 10 rem, my first program or whatever, right? So that's my domain name.
So I went there and it says, getting more visibility for your Windows Store app part one, creating great apps.
Yes.
And that's the quality issue.
Yeah. So, and I wouldn't say it's an issue. It's as Windows developers, we're all new to this concept of having a store where we can publish our apps and people can immediately go in there and rate them. And, you're a book author, I'm a book author, right? When you put something out there for people to rate, like a book on Amazon, you know that people are not generous with their stars, yes. Right?
Nor shy with their criticism.
Exactly. And it's always the worst. So it's really funny because on a book that's like $40, you'll get comments like, man, this was really expensive, but it was still a good book and stuff like this. If you write an app that is $1.99, you'll get comments like, worst $1.99 ever, right? You know, it's like, dude, it's $1.99. But anyway, so people are stingy with praise and they're kind of overflowing with criticism. And you obviously want to try and, you know, lean the bar, you know, for your app over towards the praise side of things, right? That's, you know, it's really hard to recover from a bunch of bad reviews early on when you get your app out. So I've been trying to help people, you know, first create really great apps so that they get good reviews, but also so that they, you know, kind of show off features of the platform and, you know, integrate well with Windows, and kind of use the facilities that are available to them. Because otherwise, I mean, if you're not integrating with Windows, you're not using the stuff that's there and making the most of the platform, go build a website, right? I mean, you don't, if you're not using the platform, you know, why are you creating an app?
Right, right. Now, at the bottom of your posting, I have to point out that you have a set of stickers that you clearly had printed up that say, now slower with more bugs.
Oh, all right. So those are not my stickers. Okay. You know what's really, all right. So what's really funny is those are from a company called Evil Mad Scientist, which first of all, if you're going to start a company, that's the name of the company that you want. I mean, you know, that's brilliant. Such a cool name. And they sell a lot of electronic stuff, right? They LEDs and Arduino boards and things like that. And they have these little stickers that look like the old, you know, from middle of Massachusetts, the Spags sale sticker or whatever that they had, you know, up on their products at the time. And, you know, it said like on sale or whatever, but these say now slower and with more bugs. And I've just been trying to find a place to use those because I don't dare stick one on my laptop because everybody's going to take a picture of it and it'll show up on some blog somewhere. And that's not a good message to send out. But I love the stickers. So I use them in this here.
Yes. I wanted stickers that said works on my machine, but was never quite able to get away with it.
What was funny is I almost used those stickers because I remember seeing those before, not printed ones, but the online ones that works on my machine. But I thought the slower with more bugs would be more interesting. But the heading that is under is just called test, 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 right? And so this kind of goes towards what we're talking about where, you know, folks are new to developing for these platforms and they look at, you know, like your typical app is smaller than your typical desktop program, right? I think that's pretty much, you know, a common trait there. They tend to be smaller. They tend to be a bit simpler. And for those reasons, a lot of developers assume that the testing that they have to do is less, right?
Yes.
But remember, you're putting an app out there that people are rating and they're going to download it. And if it sucks, they're going to give you one star and say, you know, for $1.49, I expected better and all that kind of right. All those comments in there, right?
For $1.49, I have to say, for $1.49, I don't expect a hell of a lot. Although you're right, our expectations have really changed. We really do expect a full-blown app for $1.49.
The economy, it's really funny because I download games and I've probably spent between media and games on Windows 8, I know I've spent a couple $100 already, right? So, which is interesting because a couple $100 got me a lot of stuff where I have software programs on my desktop that cost $800. Right. You know, there's definitely a difference there in the way the economy works for between those two sides of things. And I always just, I joke because folks are really stingy with their $1.49, but you know, a pack of gum costs $1.69 now, right? So I just have to think of it that way. But if you put an app out in the store, people are going to rate it. They tend to rate things more if they, it's just like comments on websites. They tend to comment if they don't like it as opposed if they do. I mean, you have to provide incentive for people to comment when they do like something because in general, people like to comment and rate out of rage as opposed to, you know, out of praise. And it's just some weird human thing. Like we like to beat on people. So one of those things that you need to make sure that you do, and it's a really easy thing to do, is to make sure it works, right? You know, these are PCs. There are lots of different types of machines out there. We also have ARM processors in like Surface devices. There's lots of different tablets and everything. You need to do some due diligence in, you know, testing on your own machine, testing on an ARM device if you're going to support ARM, or having a friend test on an ARM device. Not just assume it's going to work. I mean, there's a really good chance it'll work, but it's, ARM is an entirely different architecture, same API, but if you look underneath the hood there, this is a totally different architecture for the processor and how it handles memory and how it handles threading and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, there are possibilities of running into race conditions on ARM or something that you didn't see in x86 because things were optimized slightly differently. I mean, that's an odd thing to run across, but it can happen. So you need to do some due diligence in testing, and also just, you know, normal stuff like you're too close to it, you know, you might not find a bug that somebody else is going to. So that thing, taking testing seriously and making sure that you send it out for some friends to sideload, and you know, you test on a couple of different types of machines and stuff before you put it on the store is a really, really good idea. And it's really simple to do too. I mean, you could take those same friends, have them test the app out. If it works really well, you know, those same friends, just like we do when we're writing books, when the app hits the store, have them put their rating in there, you know, and, you know, say whether or not it was good or bad or whatever, right? You know, it's sort of a dirty little secret in the publishing industry that I don't know how secret it is, but, you know, those first six Amazon reviews are always requests from the publisher to different people, like, hey, go review this book, please. And hey, we'll give you a free copy. Go review this book. I mean, that's just one of the ways that you sort of seed the review system.
Yes, it used to be much worse. Just as an aside here, there was a time that you could write a review on Amazon without having an account on Amazon, without ever having purchased anything on Amazon. And so there were all these sock puppet reviews.
Yeah,
they've tightened that up, and the review system is a good bit better. And I suspect that over time we're going to see in the store more requirements for, did you actually buy this app before you review it?
Oh, absolutely. So, yes, I mean, I certainly would not encourage anybody to falsely review something, but you do want to encourage some friendly reviews up front.
I mean,
that's just the way that works, right? The interesting thing on the Amazon side, so this is so total aside here. Remember where we were, because I will forget what we were talking about. There was a show or an article, I don't remember which, that I was looking at that was talking about companies who have made their entire business out of providing reviews. You know, like you have ones that'll say they'll provide X number of Facebook likes for different things. There are ones that'll provide X number of 5-star reviews on something like Amazon. And you say, hey, I want 100 4- and 5-star reviews. And the guy would just like bid on that. And then he would have people in the East go and write those reviews. They would create lots of different accounts on Amazon, write all these reviews, or they would choose people who are like sort of professional reviewers. Like, never trust the review from the guy on Amazon who has a little top reviewer next to the name, because seriously, I mean, that's your claim to fame, is you spend all day on Amazon reviewing products. I mean, that's just odd, right? But there are ones that do it professionally, where they write these reviews, or they send it out and have people write the reviews there, and they post it on there, and that's how they get them in. And that was related to a thing where the same type of work was being done to write news stories for major news sites, where they had like all the research being done over in Asia, and they would actually read local newspapers from different places in the U.S. basically retype the story and then sell that as like a news story to the other papers. It was such a strange economy where, you know, you get one little thing out there and then it becomes a news story with its own sources that were like original content, but it's actually based on some little newspaper from East Podunk, Massachusetts or something, right?
So, yes, very strange. Yeah. So you wanted to return to talking about testing.
Yeah, so testing is definitely one of the things that you want to get done up front, because you don't want to have those reviews in the store. First of all, you don't want to piss off the people that are downloading the app, right? So that's number one. You want people to have a good experience. Number two, you want them to write about their good experience. You don't want them to write about a bad experience, right? And so you want to have those good reviews in there. And also, if you're looking at getting more visibility in the store over time, you know, when the people in the Windows Store are looking at different apps to promote, and they're you know, looking at the order in which that they list things and all that stuff, if there are a whole bunch of comments in the app up front that say it's broken, doesn't work on ARM, doesn't work on x86, crashed on my machine, crap, wasted $1.49, all that type of stuff, then the chances of you being highlighted and bumped up to the in the order are lower.
Yes.
Now, the other thing, so before anybody like just goes and commits seppuku or something like here in despair, one of the other things that we like to see in the store is if you do have problems, you turn those around and you fix them, right? And then you know, you post updates on a regular basis. If you have, you know, your first 10 reviews are this thing doesn't work on X type of hardware, if you then release an update and other people start posting that, hey, the bugs are fixed, and I've seen other apps that have these types of comments in there, then that's one way to recover from you know, early issues, you know, going in there and showing some reactivity and actually doing updates and getting new versions of the app out there.
Okay, so I want to talk to you also about what are some of the other characteristics of a great application. But before we do, I don't want to miss the opportunity to talk to you about your upcoming book, which I expect will be the second best book on Windows 8 programming for XAML and C Sharp in the market.
Do I want to ask what the first best book is going
to
be?
Well, I happen to be writing one, so I'm just assuming you'll be second best.
You remember that thing about the people who hire stuff for reviews? I wonder if I can hire them to put a whole bunch of 1 and 2 star reviews on
your book. That's all right. The pace I'm writing, you'd have nothing to worry about.
Have you seen, there was an XKCD comic about star ratings? Did you ever see that?
No, I'd like to.
I'll have to find this so you can post a link with the podcast notes, because it's great. If it was talking specifically about Amazon, but this works anywhere with 5 stars, it said something like 5 stars. If the rating for this thing is 5 stars, there was only 1 review, right? If it's like 4.5 stars, it's like, awesome, go get it. If it's like 3.5 stars, it's like, worst product ever. Don't ever go anywhere near it.
My all-time favorite XKCD cartoon is extremely simple. It's just labeled universal ingredients, and it says hydrogen, time.
Yeah, right.
Brilliant. I mean, there are times he just hits it so perfectly. So yeah. Your book, first of all, what's it called and who published it and when's it out and like okay, that?
So this is the same publisher I've used for the same for the 2 Silverlight books that I did. This one is Windows 8 XAML in Action. I recently submitted to them the final chapters that haven't gone through some of the brutal reviews, but you know, I've gone through the whole process with my development editor and all that stuff. So it's not as huge as my other books. I think it's like 600 and some odd pages, which is good. And
it's a manageable size and enough to cover everything.
It's not the 1200 pages of my Silverlight 5 book, which was just ridiculous. And it covers, you know, I don't cover everything about Windows 8 development, because it's just, it turns out it's really huge, right? I mean, you're writing about it. There's, to give decent coverage to every significant topic for a C# and XAML developer in Windows 8 would result in a very large book, right? With lots of stuff. So I cover, I think, most of the things that I find important. I took a different approach this time versus some of the previous ones, where there are a number of apps that I build in the book over the course of several chapters. So I build a simple little photo browser app that uses some pictures that are just right in the Apex to show stuff like, you know, how to create tiles and how to use the different types of views, like the grid view and the list view and all that stuff. And then later in the book, probably my favorite little app that I build in there is, it sort of looks like, you remember Asteroids?
Yes, absolutely.
So there's a little vector ship that looks like the Asteroid ship, because I am artistic enough to draw a triangle, right?
There you go.
So it's like that. But what I've done is I've made it so that if you have 2 machines, they can be controlled over Wi-Fi, so that if you control your ship on your local machine, the remote machine will reflect those changes. So there's like 2 players on screen. There's no shooting or collision or anything like that, but you see that they're synchronized across sockets, right? And I also use that to show touch input And even I write a little bit of C++ code in one chapter to show how to create a WinRT extension to integrate with the Xbox controller.
Great. Right?
So
great.
You can use the controller. So, and also accelerometer and other stuff. So lots of fun things. I know, you know, that there are topics that I haven't covered, but quite frankly, you know, you've been to the MSDN Dev Center we have for Windows. Our topics are the way that we've done coverage for Windows 8 there this time is much more comprehensive than I think we've ever done before. So, you know, there's really no point in duplicating all that, right? So I think there's lots of other stuff I tried to provide value for instead.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think the MSDN coverage is better than it has historically been. And the samples that are available for download, even from within Visual Studio, are extraordinarily good. They're to the point and easy to follow and easy to use.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, and I think those are helpful. And like my Silverlight books always had a lot of sort of API documentation included as part of it, sort of following the old Petzold Windows book type philosophy, right? And I didn't do that this time around. This is all, I think, pretty practical stuff.
Yes. Now, it's interesting what you choose to put in what and what you don't. You know, my co-author is John Galloway. And so, of course, we have a chapter on remote data services and using ASP.NET Web API with a client, which is probably one of the biggest chapters because, you know, John's really passionate about that. And so it made it in. I think it's a useful chapter, but I'm not sure it's going to be in anybody else's book because, you know, it just happens to be what John's into.
So what I'm hearing here is if somebody wants the complete Windows 8 learning experience, they just go buy both books.
That's it. That's exactly right. In fact, we should work out... It's different publishers, but we should work out a package deal.
Yeah. Are you guys with O'Reilly again?
No, this is with A-Press.
With A-Press. Okay. Yes. So you guys with A-Press again?
Well done.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Because O'Reilly and Manning have some sort of odd relationship that I've never quite fully understood. Like they use one uses the other's printing or something like that. But so that would have been more reasonable thing to do.
O'Reilly
so cool.
Also now is, I believe, is publishing the Microsoft Press books.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. It's really, you know, it's one of those things I tend not to keep up with it. I have my own little world. I've managed to get the same development editor for all three books here by my request or demand or request, right? You know, I have my own little world that I work in with creating these books.
Sure. So let me bring you back because you were talking about making great applications. And one of the things that you talked about was test, test, test.
Yeah.
But what are some of the other attributes that distinguish an okay application from a great application?
And first, let me say how odd it is for you to be the person bringing me back on topic. But yes, all right.
I take notes now.
Oh, do you? Oh, good. Because you and I together in a room, we would never get a single thing done.
Oh, so, look, a squirrel.
Yes, exactly. Squirrel. So there are lots of other things. So I mentioned integration with the operating system, right?
Yes.
So, and I said, hey, if you're not going to do that, then just go build a website. I mean, there are different reasons for building apps for getting, you know, having visibility on the platform and stuff. But I think the biggest reasons for wanting to build an app as opposed to just, you know, shoving some HTML on a site and JavaScript. Sorry, HTML and JavaScript developers. I don't mean to imply that everything is just shoving some HTML on a site and you're done. But yes, I do. But no, I don't. But yes, I do. Anyway. the reason you're going to write an app is because you want some kind of local integration. You want to take advantage of things that the platform provides. So even if you do this in HTML and JavaScript, which you can, it's one of the languages for building a native app for Windows, you want to do things like integrate with, say, like the live tiles, right? So you want to entice the user to come in and use your app. You want to show them timely information. You might want to do things like show notification toast if you have reminders that need to be displayed. You might want to do simple stuff like just, you know, integrate with or better integrate with the orientation, right? You know, being able to support the snap mode and the filled mode and the different orientations that the user has set up so that your app still works fine in landscape and portrait. You'll want to do stuff like the app bar, right? So the app bar is one of those things that unless you're writing a game, there's a really good chance that you really should have your functions inside an app bar. And it's one of the bits of functionality that, or one of the bits of comments that, some of our internal reviews give back to developers all the time that, hey, this stuff that you have on screen that's not constantly used and doesn't necessarily apply right to this particular item here on screen really should be in an app bar, so it's not taking up valuable content space on the screen, right?
Creeping Chrome.
Yeah, exactly. It's like creeping Chrome. But then there's the other thing where, you know, understanding what needs to go on something like an app bar versus what should be on screen is really something that it takes some experience with, right? I mean, you need to have kind of a designer, user experience designer in this case, mindset to figure that out. And if you don't have that right up front, then the best way to figure that out is to, you know, go have a bunch of other people try to use your app before you put it in the store, right? I mean, if they can't find functions or they really think this function should be right on the screen versus in the app bar, et cetera, then you can use that feedback. There's other stuff, just like all the different APIs. I mean, the networking support, you know, you were talking about what you and John wrote about using Web API, which I love Web API. I had the biggest chapters of my Silverlight 5 book were all about using Web API because it was just, it's such a fun thing to use. The, you know, all the networking support you have for that, as well as for sockets, is, you know, pretty stellar, right? So you can even open peer-to-peer sockets from one machine to another, which for those of us who came from the Silverlight land is like, wow, you can do that? Because we could not do that before, if you recall.
Right.
So, you know, you can just have two machines say, hey, I want to open a socket, and then have them communicate very quickly with each other to be able to do some really interesting development for synchronization between the two. It's really fast. It's reliable. You know, all the code that you're using is actually native code down in WinRT. So, it performs really, really well. And you can even use WebSockets. So that's a, you know, a kind of a standard thing that HTML and JavaScript folks are used to. But you can go and use that from C# and XAML if you want, which is, you know, kind of crazy. And it works, right? So that's a fun thing as well.
How much do you talk about supporting SnapView and doing that well and supporting multiple resolutions and doing that well?
So I do talk a bit about that. It was one of the earlier chapters I wrote. So I don't remember how much, but I do have an entire chapter that's about these different views and different resolutions, and not just different resolutions, but I do also cover things like different DPIs. You know, you really should provide images that support the different DPIs for different devices. Because if you think, you know, a 10-inch or 10.7 or 11 or whatever the surface is here at 1366 by 768 is not the same DPI as the same size screen running at, you know, 1920 by 1080 or 2048 by whatever, right? And so Windows does a lot more now to install by default at higher DPIs if the screen supports the higher DPI, so you can get smoother text rendering and stuff like that. Now, when you take an image and you show it at a higher DPI, but the image is really just being scaled up, you know, it looks like crap, right? I mean, on something where all the lines are very crisp and there's, you know, we have this thing where, you know, everything's kind of like in many apps, a box layout, and the app bar buttons all have, you know, specific circles and stuff around them, having a low res image shoved in with all those sticks out like a sore thumb. So, you know, what the developers of the platform have done is they've made it possible for you to name your images in such a way that if you say like mybutton.scale-100.png, if you also provide a .scale-140.png and .scale-180.png, it will automatically swap in the correct DPI image at runtime, based on what the user's DPI is. So, I mean, little things like that, I think, are very important to adding that level of kind of crispness to your UI. And so I talk about those things. I do definitely talk about, you know, SnapView and the default templates. So there's some things I don't like about the default templates. Like I don't particularly care for their MVVM implementation, although I understand why they went the way they did, because they're, you know, trying to be very generic. And if you want to provide a generic way to provide a view model to a view, you need to shove it in a property bag, basically. I mean, you can't have, you know, type names and stuff in there that directly in the code. But one thing that I think was done extremely well in the templates is the way they handle the view management, which is to just have visual states on the individual pages that control what things look like when you're in snapped view versus filled view versus different orientations on the screen.
Yeah, no, I thought it was a brilliant extension of the visual state manager. And it's interesting because when you look at your book, which I've seen in preview, and some of the other books, the visual state manager now comes up in terms of SnapView, but not pretty much at all in the traditional terms that we used to talk about it with Silverlight, where it was pretty much talked about for templating and for creating custom controls.
Right. I mean, I had a whole section on Visual State Manager in my previous books where I think I was showing how to create something that was like a button. But quite honestly, not 90% of the people out there are not doing that. Right. And even in Silverlight, most of the people were not doing that. There's some hardcore folks that were creating their own controls and they were doing a lot of stuff with creating their own visual states and whatnot. But most people aren't. Most people are using the stock stuff that's in there, customizing some of the stock properties and never even going in and saying like viewing the control template in Blender or something like that. So this time around, I decided to just cover the visual states in the place where they will run into them, which is in the view state management on the individual pages.
Okay, switch gears with me, and let's talk a little bit about Windows 8 and the success or lack of success of Windows 8. Now, I know that you're with Microsoft, and so to some degree you're constrained, but what's your perspective on how Windows 8 is doing and how it's likely to do?
Yeah, so I don't really keep track of the bigger picture of that. I mean, I'm assuming it's doing well because we posted our revenue numbers and stuff for last quarter and those look pretty good. So instead, let me give you more of a personal view of it, right? So my wife, for Christmas, I bought her an Acer S7, which is a touchscreen ultrabook. I don't know if you've seen those, but absolutely, it's gorgeous piece of hardware. Super thin. I'd encourage people if you're looking for bonus points with your spouse, an Acer S7 is definitely a good way to go.
Okay.
Very light, right? Again, very thin. You know, it's roughly the back of it's about the thickness of the USB ports that they have to support. But it has a 1920 by 1080 touchscreen on it. And my wife had a little bit of experience with Windows 8 just with my son's Ultrabook before, my son's netbook. He has my old netbook. There's like 30 laptops in my house. My son has my old netbook, which is not a touchscreen and quite honestly has a really crappy touchpad, but he's been using Windows 8 on it just fine. But my wife was not sure that, one, she would like a touchscreen, right? Because everybody always thinks, well, I'm not going to be touching my screen all the time. And you see the comments about Gorilla Arm and all that kind of stuff. I said, no, trust me, from somebody who has been using a combination touchscreen laptop for a while, you're going to reach out and touch stuff because it's just easier. And so she started using it for a bit and she found out that she was, touching the screen to scroll things and stuff. And she found that the Windows 8 side, the modern UI side of things with those apps works so much better in that environment for her versus her experience with my son's crappy touchpad for those things, right? So she really became a convert to, this hybrid model of using the touchpad, typing, and also, using the screen to do certain, you can't see what I'm doing right now, but I'm flicking at my screen here to mimic the actions that she's doing.
Yes.
Just for simple stuff like scrolling or, so she'll, just to do things like, dismiss a dialogue on the screen, right? So hitting the okay button, rather than, sort of fiddle with the touchpad over there to get your mouse in the right spot to, take it out of the context of what you're doing to dismiss a dialogue, she just reaches over and touches the screen and she's done, right? So there are lots of things like that she's found that she really, really likes about touchscreen laptops. And I bring up touchscreen laptops because they're really coming out as part of this wave of Windows 8. So that's one thing. That's a hardware thing. By the way, my kids absolutely love my Surface. Every time I bring it upstairs, they're on it and I don't get any time with it at all. So, I use it all the time and they use it whenever I'm not using it, right? The second part of that is, the apps and the whole ecosystem for apps there. Like if I look at my main desktop here, I spend most of my time in Windows 8 on my desktop, right? I mean, that's as power users, we tend to do that, right? I mean, Visual Studio, Word, really, those are two things I spend most of my time on, right? Are all desktop apps. So I do spend the most of my time there. However, there are some apps, especially games and other stuff that I found that I just really like to go and play on the modern side of things. And I'll do those on my desktop. But then, we'll get the cloud saved state of those apps and everything. So I can also pick up certain things back over on my Surface and whatnot. And I really enjoy doing that as well. Right. But I do have, for the most part, two different types of of uses for Windows 8, where on my Surface, I almost never go into the desktop side of things unless I have to do some obscure configuration of settings, or I have to start up the remote debugging support, which you know is a desktop app in there. Whereas on my desktop, which is 2 30-inch screens, not touch screens, I tend to spend most of my time on the desktop and only a little bit of time over on the modern app side, right?
Right.
One thing that I have found that helped me out a lot there as a desktop user, which I think most of the people on the that listen to your podcast are probably stationary users of some sort, whether they sit at a desk with a laptop that's connected to a big screen, or they have a regular old desktop, they probably spend most of their time sitting on their butt doing something in front of the computer, I would imagine. One thing that I found really makes Windows 8 more enjoyable for me is I've got one of these Logitech touchpads, and I wrote a short review of it on my website. And I think Scott Hanselman also recently wrote something up about it as well, where it's about, I'm looking at it here, what's it, about 5 inches by 5 inch square glass top touchpad that also does gesture support and supports, two finger scrolling, which I don't know where that's been my whole life, but
it's been on Macs. That's where it's been your whole life.
Yeah. Right. So those other aluminum looking things, right?
Right.
It's one of those things that, sure, there are lots of people that may have been using it all this time, but I've just recently discovered it and I could not live without it now because I use two finger scrolling here all the time. But also the touchpad also does the edge swipes, right, for invoking the charms bar.
That's great.
And it also does a three fingered swipe for switching back and forth between the desktop and the start page, right? And I found that those things have made it even more enjoyable for me to use Windows 8. Cause the thing that comes up with people all the time is the context switching between those different parts and how there are some things that seem more optimized for touch and are a little more difficult to do on a mouse based machine. This really helps bridge that gap for you and eliminate some of that.